and welcome to Inside Education. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. You can listen to or download podcasts of previous Inside Education programmes on our website insideed.com. On this week's programme, I speak to the principal of St Lawrence O'Toole CBS in Seville Place in Dublin 1. Located near the Five Lamps Junction or Connolly Station, the school serves an area that has been designated as disadvantaged. The principal, Mark Candon, tells the story of how he set about improving conditions and raising standards in a school that had seen better days. He shares his experiences with us and his thoughts about the challenges that schools face in raising outcomes for children. Mark Candon first gives us some historical background to the area where St Lawrence O'Toole School is situated.
You have an area that was, we'd say, built on reclaimed land from the sea that served the docks, right? And you interesting developments in that area over the 100-150 years. You know, it was the hub. You had the boats, you had the trains, etc. So you had warehouses, you had lots where people, you know, brought stuff in. So before containerization in the 60s, obviously it was very labour intensive. And I mean, again, what Schumpeter would call the creative destruction, as the technology changed, as the labour intensivity went out of it, you had unemployment, you had people moved out of the area and so forth and so on. Then, of course, you have the whole planning thing. Housing is very important here. You have the building of the flats in the North Wall. There are issues then about the housing policy and who got moved in and who got moved out and how all that sort of stuff was handled. People moved out of the area. People, you know, rehoused into the suburbs up around, you know, Darndale, Whitehall, etc., etc., etc. So that reduced the numbers in the area, and then the numbers in the school fell, and then obviously things, unemployment, you know, and then you have the whole thing with Dublin's inner city, the drugs epidemic in the 80s and the early 90s. So all of these things impacted, and one of the things I've always said is that to a certain extent, that school almost was a microcosm, you know, and a mirror of the problems. It didn't work. It had a lot of problems.
By 2000, the numbers attending the school had fallen to 57 pupils.
But if you looked at the cohorts available to come to us, or more than half of them by 2000 were going to other schools outside of the area, because the school was seen not to work. But at the same time, the community wanted our school, wanted to have its, be able to send its children to school locally, its boys. The girls still went locally. And maybe the school wasn't delivering it wasn't working as a school. As a teacher, right, I have a belief in the national school system in this country and what it can be or what it is at its best. I mean, one of my last teaching practices has been a four-teacher school, right, infants to sixth class, two classes per teacher in County Meath. Marvellous school, wonderful. And I have a sort of an idealised vision of that. And all the children locally, you know, went to that school, the rich, the poor, the whole lot. Now, what's interesting is when they left sixth class, they did break up, some of them to private schools, some of them to the community college and so forth and so on, which I'd have an issue with. But that vision of what we can deliver as schooling, and that, to me, a vision of equality, that you get the same service, you get a decent service from the school, right? Now, what happened here was that as the community, to a certain extent, and particularly the lives of the men and the lives of the boys, you know, fell apart. Your role, there's no work, you know what I mean? There's no, you don't have an identity, a role, there's that. And that very much impacted on the school and impacted in the behaviours of the kids. And the thing just kind of had gone downhill.
That was the situation that Mark Candon set about turning around in June 2000.
One of the teachers said to me in my first week, "You do realise this is one of the worst, three worst schools in the country." And I was like, "Oh, is that right?" I didn't really realise that. And the next thing he said to me, "Oh yeah, and over the last 20 years, the other two have changed, but we have kept our position," right? So to a certain extent, right, you get used to a certain way of being, right? If you're not going to have, you know, I mean, that's an identity in itself, you know what I mean? And what I've seen as well, I mean, my career has been working in what we refer to as disadvantaged schools, right? Okay, so schools in working class communities. And you can fall into this thing of you spend most of your time trying to maintain order and discipline. So, I mean, I kind of thought about that, and I said, okay, well, the challenge here is well, if this is this bad, and if people have said don't go near it, and it's, well, can it be done? And my view was, is yeah, it can, right? And yes, it should. So when I got to the school, I mean, as I told you, I mean, just the bleakness of it. I remember bringing somebody in, they said, oh my God, it's like a prison. And you had a lot of our kids going on to prison. And so one of the things I would have said straight away is just the physical condition of the environment that we're expecting these children to get an education in is appalling. You couldn't heat the place. We had children sitting there in coats. One incident, actually, where for about 20-something days in a row, in my first winter there, the heating was below the minimum level. And I just had a meeting with two of the senior teachers in the corridor and said, look, what do we do here? You know, the kids are sitting in the classes in the coats, so they're freezing. Everybody says, we can get up and dance. And one teacher said, oh, yeah, we should close the place. And the other teacher said, well, if we close the place, we'll never open again. Well, there was a very stark choice. I remember my first year, for most of that year, over a third of that year, I was the only qualified teacher out of five or six, I think, of the place. I was the only qualified teacher there.
You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, insideed.com. My guest today is Mark Candon, who is principal of St. Lawrence O'Toole CBS in Dublin. Mark is telling us about his experience of taking on the principalship of the school, which is in a historically disadvantaged area, and the practicalities, the challenges, and the successes of his work in that position over the course of a decade or so.
I said to the board at the time, so I'm going to give you 3 years, and in 3 years there will be discipline and order. There will be a decent teaching staff. There will be teaching and learning going on, because there wasn't. And there will be a building. And in 3 years, if I haven't achieved that, I'm gone. I'm out of here. Right. So that was the challenge I set myself.
Although the previous principal had two sets of plans drawn up, one for refurbishing the school and the other for rebuilding it, a long drawn out process usually follows before changes are made. But Mark Candon managed to expedite this process.
I had started in June of 2000. We moved out into prefabs in the yard, which was appalling. By the end of that school year, we spent a school year in those prefabs and moved in the following May. Right? And then we had and one of the great things about that, for me anyway, was there was a wonderful company, architectural company, who were in charge of that, and a very good building company. And I got to work with the architect around stuff like colour, light, and how we would redesign the place. We used to have urinals at the end of the corridor. So you had two smells when you entered the place. One was either of urine, the other one was of Jay's fluid. And I had a sense of school as community. So, I mean, stuff like the classrooms and storerooms for the teachers. This is about respect. I mean, my whole thing is about respect all the time. And that there was, you know, off the toilets for the children were off the classrooms, and all these little things matter in terms of, you know, there are windows on both sides of the building, so the light comes right across the school, so it's you know, very bright, big into displays on walls. So there are different things. So that was, we'd say, the building end of it. The discipline end of it was an absolute fight, because I had to negotiate some things with fifth or sixth class. But, I mean, these guys weren't going to... I remember having a discussion with a guy in sixth class one day, and I was saying, it wasn't a discussion, it was me basically saying, right, buddy, you won't do that here. And he pointed out to me, not unreasonably, that he had come up through the school and that they'd been bullied all the way up along. And now it was their turn. They were now in sixth class, they were now in charge. And why was I taking this right away from them? And I remember saying to him, well, you know what? In fairness to you, you have a point. But unfortunately, if we continue in that way, we're never going to get anywhere. And at times, funnily, because change is very hard for people, I found to a certain extent the kids could be more reasonable than either the teachers or the parents. I remember I had some mad ideas about student councils and empowering kids and all this kind of empowering teachers when I came in first. I remember saying that at the board, and the parents of the board were complete, they won't be able to do it, was the view, right? Which ties into a greater point that gets me in Irish education, right? And I know at the moment OECD and whoever we're doing, it's this whole thing about teaching independence and the dependency and independency culture, right? And trusting kids and trusting people and trusting teachers to get on and create the space for them to do their job. And I would be a strong believer in that. So look, in turning the place around, started with second class. I remember second class at the time, there was somebody coming in doing drama, and that person would take the class for drama and it would be chaos. So I remember saying to the teacher, okay, well, let's strategize this. Okay, so here's what we'll do. The person taking the drama will take them out in a different room. So the class will go on as normal. And we say to the class, okay, look, you have to earn the drama, right? So we started week one, two or three of them, right? And I remember saying to the person doing the drama, we're like, look, make sure now that the guys come back with a really good story to tell our pals, right? And then we do it slow, because we're not in a hurry here, we take our time. So by the end of that year, we'd say we'd started that in after Christmas. So by May, we had the whole class doing drama in a completely different culture. Because we had broken it down, we had made this a special thing. We allowed the person doing it to have the space to set a few, you know, parameters, guidelines. This is how we do this in this class. It wasn't something you just went in and did and you could carry on in. It was something that had to be earned, and I'm a believer in that. And then that nearly became unimportant by June, where we just all did it, and we all did it in this way. So that, to a certain extent, explains the kind of philosophy behind, you know, school turnaround in that issue. So my predecessor had started with the parents a uniform, and there had been a competition at the time for a crest. So I kind of looked at it, so we'll develop that idea. So the other thing is, we met the parents and went for a tracksuit as well. And then with the crest, I looked at this and I thought, well, okay, we need to identify this school. And one thing I said, well, who are we? Where are we? Well, we're in the docks. Our culture and our history is about being docks. These are strong people. These are proud people. So I came up with a motto for the school, Larriers, which would be the nickname of the school, Strong and Proud. So every day we do this, and you can't see it on radio, but it's like I said to the kids, Larriers, Strong and Proud. And little things like that create identity, create a sense of purpose. Let's talk about the discipline. Every rule should have a reason. You know, I've seen about, oh, you won't do that around here. No, we don't. Well, why? What is the reason? And I would say to lads, I've seen lads wearing huge, big diamond earrings. They were very popular a few years ago when Beckham was wearing them in both ears. I said, well, all right, lads, there's a problem with these. You get a smack of the ball in the ear at break time, or there's a messing. You know, you're going to do damage. So we wear a small stud or a sleeper, or even put a plaster on it. But things have got to be reasonable. You talk to people, you negotiate. And I would say to you, if you look at the moment, what we've done in relation to desh schools, in relation to small schools, you know, was it Mel and Kim sang the song, it ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. That's what gets results. So if you look at how the department has dealt with schools at the moment, okay, through the budgetary process, they have attacked the desh game. There hasn't been an issue of sitting down and talking to people about this. Now, is that going to work? I mean, that is a question. Is that the way that we should deal with people?
Okay, but they will, the department will come back to you and they'll say, okay, maybe that's not where we need to cut money, but we need to cut spending. How can they do it?
I got in trouble for this because I went, as they say, outside the fold. I had a letter to the Irish Times where I basically said they decided to cut the PTO by two. Okay, now from a disadvantaged perspective, if they were going to cut, and by the way, they'd already cut special education, they'd already cut traveller education, there had already been under the previous administration cuts to the education services. Now, in fairness, I think we ran a brilliant campaign as INTO about numbers and about, because, you know, we have one of the highest PTR ratios in the world, in the developed world. But I think, unfortunately, we won on that one. So then, I mean, as far as I can see, the word came down to the department. Well, we can't do that politically. Find it somewhere else. So we're finding it in the disadvantaged schools. I also think there's a culture. Look, I have what is technically a four-teacher school with 12 teachers. Now, I am not going to apologise for that when I start looking at the numbers of young people that have gone through our school and who have gone on, who have come in and gone out illiterate. And that's in my time. I don't mind whoever went before me. I went into a class one day, very, very difficult class. The teacher was at the class. All the boys had a history book open in front of them, right? They were not engaged and they were being disruptive. And I just kind of observed for a minute or two. And I said to the teacher, I said, look, can you see a problem? Like, what problem do you see here? And the teacher's attitude was, look, it's the usual with these. They don't want to be here or whatever else, right? So that was his take on it, right? And I said, well, okay, let's look at this a little bit differently. I said, look, these boys are in fifth class. and they have a fifth class history book in front of them. But the problem here is that there isn't one boy in this class who is at a reading level that he can engage with that book. So I said, the issue here is if you put a book in front of me that I can't read, you're making me look stupid. And you make me look stupid, I don't want to look. So I'm going to start carrying on just even to distract the attention from that. So it's about ways of thinking about stuff. So, I mean, one of the things that we would have done in the beginning would have been, I said, okay, we have a new curriculum, let's teach it. So we got rid of the books, right? So if I'm teaching history, I'll be Strongbow and you could be Dermot McMurrah, and let's go with it. You know what I mean? And I try to encourage, I suppose, and had discussions about this. And it was like, okay, how do we teach rather than just having a text and the fatal workbook in front of us and whatever else? Well, you have resistance from parents on that. Because I remember parents coming into me and saying, well, what are you doing? Because he's on level 7 and the other fella's on level 5 and you've all of these issues to get over. But we did. I would say to you that one of the tests, you know, you have all the standardized tests. And one of the tests that I'm fond of is the Star or the Herald, right? And can you read it and explain to me what's going on in it? And that's a sixth class test that I use. So today, every child leaving that school, right? Bar none, I think. Yeah, no, every child today can do that. So there's a literacy level there. You need to read at a 12-year-old level to engage with first-year texts in the second-level school. Working class children aren't. And I'll give you one very, very simple example. There are a couple of papers done by Jerry McCrork, is it, over in UCD. And he has a wonderful, in two of these papers, it comes to the European Journal, but he has a wonderful little graph where he shows the percentile scores in a middle class school and a working class school. And there's a huge difference, right? And that's where you're starting from. Let me put it another way. If a teacher works with me, right, and you test the reading scores of the classes that teacher's had over 2 or 3 years, right, okay, and they're kind of down well below the national norms or whatever else, but you're looking at this teacher, this is a great teacher, and that teacher moves on, and she gets a job in Clontarf, and you test her reading scores over 2 or 3 years, and she's a marvellous teacher, and they're way above the national average. Well, what does that tell you? Same teacher, different groups of kids. Schools can't compensate for society, Sean. Basil Bernstein said it in 1970. It's still true. What I would say to you is this, and what frustrates me is that going in, I remember somebody from the department saying to me, Mark, I've no doubt that you'll probably get a bit of order in this place and it'll be good, but you'll never teach them to read. And that was interesting. And my determination has been that we will teach them to read. But it's a cultural thing. It's about your exposure to it. It's about how you value it. I come back to that analogy I use of the house and the foundations. And I think there is research to back this now. You know, research that goes right back to the kind of the effect that the environment has even on the child before birth, right? You know, accents. I mean, I've read this somewhere. It's amazing that the child has already started to pick up the accent from the womb. I remember talking to one of the girls, one of my mums, and we were talking about, you know, the minister had said people should read stories to their children. Well, there's two issues here. Some people don't read, so that makes it difficult. But I remember she said to me, "So, Mark, it never occurred to me. I would be putting my kids to bed and we'd have a chat." So again, you're talking cultural change here and you're talking what children bring in with them in the first instance. So I left in 2010. So we have the third green flag. We have we have all these awards, right, you know. They're the boys in our community, okay. What do they love and what do they cherish and what do they aspire to? And what are they good at? The game of association football, soccer, right. And we're a small little school, right. They hadn't won anything for 15 or 20 years or whatever it was. When I went in there, right. I remember bringing them out. I mean, arousing, no organisation, right. They've won the league 8 out of the last 10 or 11 years. That's hugely important to them. They're a small school. They can play football. And it's poetry. And it's marvellous. And they can go out there and they've won the Pegasus Cup, I think, twice as well in that time. Well, we don't value that in a system where and look, the literacy and numeracy course is absolutely vital and important. But that's what's important to them. And we created a structure wherein they could be very, very successful in that. I mean, another thing I'd say is one of the teachers there, we have kids playing guitar, and they've done phenomenally well. In my opinion, Ireland, is a the issue is class. Okay, gender, race, these things are important, but the issue is class. The mediating mechanisms, we're not sure, but what we are sure of is right, okay, that if you take the 10 deciles, right, in terms of where you stand economically, and you correlate that with your education outcomes, they correlate very closely, right? So what we've done as a school, we've built a nice school, right? And I remember somebody said to me, Fairdy Kelly actually at the time worked for the brothers. And Freddie said to me at the beginning, and he was very good to us, and he worked very closely with my predecessor. Mark, he said, what do you want to do? And I said, Freddie, I want to build a school. I want to build a school. I want us to build a school here that is kind of community, that respects the kids, and we've done that. We've achieved that. We've won awards. On the teaching and learning thing, here's a couple of interesting things. Stuff that is really good is stuff like the green flag. You've got the kids engaged and involved, you know. You've got kids going around giving out about teachers leaving lights on and about the state of the staff room and about the recycling there. You know, you go up to a certain classroom, everything's recycled. There's hardly dust in the bin even. Incredible stuff. Discover Primary Science. Wonderful. That's our science programme. But it's wonderful and it's engaged and it's physical and all the rest of it. And, you know, I know Paddy Madden was on here and the mini beasts. God, we love the mini beasts and all of that type of learning. And so I have a few little theories about like bus lane theory, right? You know, what's bus lane theory? Do you ever drive on a Sunday? I love driving on a Sunday because I whiz up and down the bus lanes, but nobody does because we have been so trained now into staying out of the bus lane. And to me in school, it was the same thing. Of course, you're going to behave yourself when you come in here, you know. And there are people saying, well, you know, and there is a good question here. If we're not delivering for certain sections of our society, is this just social control? Is this just a training, you know what I mean, and keeping people off the streets? But I would say to you, if you have a group of children, right, and you look at them and you look at how long they live, you look at the rates of death by misadventure, you look at the numbers who have gone to prison, you look at their literacy levels, and we've got to ask ourselves as a society, you know, How well have we treated those children? How well have we looked after them? You know, and you know, we got our independence, and we talked about cherishing all the children. So what I'd say to you, Sean, is this: starting with Coleman's report in 1966, the War on Poverty, okay, and Jenks's follow-up report in 1972, where they both basically said, well, like, look, you know, Bernstein put it best: schools can't compensate for society. So they said, well, you know, more or less, schools have only a limited impact. And then we got into the whole school effectiveness and school improvement movements, who were determined to say, people like Tedley and Reynolds and these people who were simply, no, schools must and should have a difference. After 40 years of this, right, okay, and they measured this statistically, the best difference, now there's one outlier study in Australia that says something like 50 or 60%, but the best Tedley and Reynolds could come up with was a difference of between 8 and 15%. That's the difference schools make. I remember Tom Kelligan said it in the paper he did on where he considered critically our conceptions of disadvantage in this country. And he just said, look, education is a middle-class pursuit. So let's start from there. Now, we've got to decide as a country, then, if we've moved into this era of technology and life, what do you call it, knowledge economy and all this kind of carry on. Well, okay. Well, then, how are we preparing children for schooling? Because if schooling is only going to give you between 8 and 15% of the difference, right, okay, well, what is it that you bring to school? I look at kids every Halloween, right, and it's like the marble season. It just comes out of nowhere. It just happens. I look at kids collecting. I look at the intelligence involved in groups of kids collecting wood for bonfires, hiding it, taking it from other groups. I look at all of the War of the Button stuff going on and the massive intelligence involved in this. And there's nobody in charge. There's no lead. And it's organic, and it's phenomenal to look at. There's intelligence there. I look at the wit and the humour of the kids that I work with, their understandings. It's marvellous stuff. Of course schools make a difference, but I come back again to the likes of Tedley and Reynolds, who were not happy with the fact that Coleman, Jenks and these people said schools make about 10, 12% of a difference. They spent 40 years trying to disprove that, and they find that schools make about that, 8 to 15% of a difference. But within that difference that we make, okay, let's do our best. And let me put it this way. I don't think we're going to rush madly for equality anytime soon, okay? So in relation to some of the poorest communities in the country, what can we do, okay? And this is in relation to the study that I'm doing. A lot of the kids and the parents that I've interviewed basically said they don't want their children to leave and go to second level school, right? Now, we're all about pupil voice now and listening to communities. I don't really think we do, to be honest with you. I think that's another kind of play along with that. But how would that look? How would it look if we decided that in certain communities where we don't know that we're making the educational impact we were hoping for, we look at the structure of the system? Because it seems to me that there is all the stuff that we've done, you know, we look at student transfer, and it's a big issue around transferring from primary to secondary school. Okay, let's solve the problem. Let's remove it. Let's not transfer. But we don't seem to be thinking in that way. Now, look, let's say the system works well. Depends who you talk to. But let's say the system works well for somewhere between, is about 70% of the kids. And let's say there's 20, 30% of the kids, it ain't working as well as it should. And let's look at where they are. And let's look at, is there particular communities? Well, what can we do differently? Okay? I would say to you that if the children that come through our school start off going to the local creche, the group I was talking about, they might spend a year or two there. Then they go to the junior boys. Then they come to us. Then they go on to second level. I mean, do we not think there's an issue with that amount of change? Because let me put it another way. No matter how, I had this discussion actually recently with a teacher friend of mine. Two schools, same building, the junior and senior, right? And I asked, when they amalgamated, did it make a difference? And it did, even though they'd worked very, very closely before that. So it's about what's the culture, what's the ethos, what's our approach? Do you know what I mean? I don't know if that's making sense to you, but I look at this and say, why in Ireland is the structure of the system so sacrosanct, almost? I'm not looking to be overly negative about this either, but I do want to be a little bit of a realist. I think, and this is the reason I said to you, we have the best staff school in the country. We've worked extremely hard. We have phenomenal teachers. I've had inspectors come through the place say, I don't know, Mark, how you're going to hold on to them, right? And most have stayed, right? It's as good as it gets, but there's a ceiling in relation to what I'd say to you is socioeconomic inequality, for want of a better phrase. There's a ceiling to what you can achieve in schools, right? And to get beyond that, well, then you're going to have to look outside it.
And that was Mark Candon from St. Lawrence O'Toole CBS in Seville Place in Dublin. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. And remember, we and our guests love to receive your feedback. Thanks to our guest this week, Mark Candon. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.